As you all know by now, my academic background's in law, and more specifically, civil liberties, con law, and the Bill of Rights. Now, in the Bill of Rights, the definition of liberty that animates that document and the jurisprudence subsequently interpreting it tells us when government has to respect these declarations of my body, my choice. Now, we've been hearing that slogan a lot from the people who are refusing to be vaccinated. And ironically, they're often the very same people who label themselves pro-life and then vigorously oppose a woman's right to control her body if that includes the right to terminate a pregnancy. I'm here this morning to tell you that the anti-vaxxers who are throwing that slogan around have it exactly backwards. The founders who crafted our Constitution and Bill of Rights were influenced by the philosophy of the Enlightenment and by what we call the libertarian construct, the belief that we humans have an inborn right to do our own thing, to pursue our own interests, form our own beliefs, and make our own life choices free of government interference until and unless we are harming the person or property of someone else, and so long as we're willing to grant an equal right to others. Now, let me repeat that. We have an inborn right to do our own thing, to pursue our own interests, form our own beliefs, make our own life choices and moral judgments free of government interference until and unless we are harming the person or property of someone else, and so long as we're willing to grant an equal right to others. Now, that approach to human rights means that government has to refrain from interfering with citizens' political or religious beliefs, but it also means that government has a duty to protect its citizens from harm. Philosophers like Hobbes believe that that was a major purpose of government, to keep the strong from taking advantage of the weak, to protect citizens from threats, both foreign and domestic. Now, we can and we do quibble over the nature and the degree of the kinds of harms that justify government action. But if government can protect us from drunk drivers and the dangers of passive smoke, a dangerous and frequently fatal pandemic is pretty clearly a sufficient basis for government rulemaking. Rather obviously, a pregnant woman's decision to terminate her pregnancy, unlike the dangers of disease transmission, poses no threat of harm to her neighbors. For constitutional purposes, legal purposes, the operative word here is decision. Despite all the rhetoric, the issue we are debating in America is not whether abortion is right or wrong, good or bad. The issue is who gets to make that decision, the individuals involved, the woman involved, or the government. In our constitutional system, decisions about the religion you'll follow, the books you'll read, the political philosophy you'll embrace, and a lot of others are supposed to be left to the individual. What the courts have called intimate decisions, like those about whom you will marry and whether you will procreate, are supposed to be left up to individual citizens, not imposed by the government. I agree with the people who point out that so-called pro-life movement is really pro-birth. Most of the legislators who identify themselves with the pro-life label are clearly unconcerned about the lives of women or about feeding, housing, and educating those babies once they're born. And a considerable number of them are gun nuts. But I wasn't asked to speak about the considerable dishonesties of the anti-choice position. I was asked to focus on what will happen if, as most of us anticipate, the current packed Supreme Court eviscerates or overrules Roe v. Wade. You know, history is always instructive. So let's take a quick look back at the actual origins of the anti-abortion movement. there's a noted religion scholar, Randall Balmer, and he's documented those origins, and his account has been confirmed by several other historians. It wasn't until 1979, which was a full 6 years after the court decided Roe v. Wade, that evangelical leaders, goaded on by Paul Weyrich, seized on abortion as a rallying cry to deny President Jimmy Carter a second term. Objecting to abortion was seen as more palatable than what was really motivating them, which was protecting the segregated schools they'd established following the court's decision in Brown versus Board of Education. And that is why they wanted to get rid of Carter. According to Balmer, and this next is a quote, both before and for several years after Roe, evangelicals were overwhelmingly indifferent to the subject, which they considered a Catholic issue. In 1968, for instance, a symposium sponsored by the Christian Medical Society and Christianity Today, the flagship magazine of evangelicalism, refused to characterize abortion as sinful, citing individual health, family welfare, and social responsibility as justifications for ending a pregnancy. In 1971, delegates to the Southern Baptist Convention in St. Louis passed a resolution encouraging Southern Baptists to work for legislation that will allow the possibility of abortion under such conditions as rape, incest, clear evidence of severe fetal deformity, and carefully ascertained evidence of the likelihood of damage to the emotional, mental, and physical health of the mother. The convention, hardly a redoubt of liberal values, reaffirmed that position in 1974, 1 year after Roe, and again in 1976. That's the end of the quote. Let me emphasize that. It was right-wing anger about civil rights laws that actually motivated the Right to Life movement. The right wing was savvy enough to recognize that organizing grassroots evangelicals in order to defend racial discrimination wasn't going to cut it, that they'd need a different issue if they wanted to mobilize sufficient numbers of evangelical voters. The bottom line is that what motivated the Christian right's political activism, including but not limited to its opposition to abortion, was racism and defense of racial segregation. I want to give credit where credit's due. That tactic has been incredibly successful. Christian nationalists now own one of America's two political parties. And I say that as someone who worked hard for the Republican Party for 35 years. Mitch McConnell has achieved the GOP's fever dream of taking over the Supreme Court and installing Republican ideologues. And much as it pains me to say this, with the imminent demise of Roe, we're looking at what is probably only the first of many times that this particular court will roll back what we've thought of as established liberties. So, what now? If Roe is overruled, or more likely, effectively neutered, there will certainly be some horrible consequences. But there may also be some unanticipated positives. We've all come up against the intransigence of those one-issue anti-choice voters, the people who disagree with Republicans about virtually everything else, but still vote Republican because they're pro-life. With Roe gone, I think many of them will abandon the GOP. They won, so hopefully they will be less motivated. Losing Roe will also make it much more difficult to energize the national movement against birth control, which is actually a target of the most rabid anti-choice activists, a significant number of whom, sorry guys, are men who want women barefoot, pregnant, and back in the kitchen. Bottom line, anti-choice voters have been a mainstay of the GOP, and at the federal level at least, they will arguably be considerably less motivated. If Roe is no longer the law of the land, the issue will revert to the states, and a number of states will opt to protect reproductive choice. Those of us who care about women's autonomy are going to need to do some serious fundraising to make it possible for poor women in red states to travel to places where abortion's legal. And that's a pain. But even now, with abortion theoretically legal, there are many places in the U.S. where clinics are few and far between, where women have to travel long distances, put up with bogus, medically inaccurate counseling, and deal with other barriers to the exercise of what is currently a constitutional right to terminate a pregnancy. What the denationalization of Roe might do, what it should do, and what one of my sons says it won't do, but is redirect liberal and pro-choice energies from national to state level political action. And while there are no guarantees, that could be a huge game changer. The current agenda of the Republican Party, to the extent it even has an agenda, does not reflect the desires of the American majority. Far from it. GOP numbers have been shrinking steadily. Some 24% of voters self-identify as Republican. Their electoral success has been due primarily to the 2011 gerrymander, and that was made possible because they controlled a large number of state governments when redistricting took place. More recent GOP vote suppression tactics that have depressed Democratic turnout and disenfranchised Democratic voters have also been facilitated by state-level control. In many states, possibly even Indiana, redirecting voters' attention to state-level politics could change that. Without Roe, it's reasonable to predict that the single-issue anti-choice voters who've been a mainstay of the GOP will be less motivated to vote. Pro-choice voters, however, will be newly energized, and polling suggests that they significantly outnumber these so-called pro-life activists. The most recent Pew survey found that 61% of Americans say abortion should be legal in all or most cases. 27% say in all cases, and another 34% say in most cases. Only 12% of the public says abortion should be illegal in all cases, and only 26% would outlaw it in most cases. In anticipation of the loss of Roe, some states have already seen efforts to protect reproductive rights. A ballot drive has been launched in Michigan by a group called Reproductive Freedom for All, and their petition would affirm the right to make pregnancy-related decisions without interference, including about abortion and other reproductive services, such as birth control. The groups leading that effort are Planned Parenthood Advocates of Michigan, the Michigan ACLU, and an organization called Michigan Voices. New Jersey has already enshrined abortion rights in state law. Lawmakers in that state bolster protections for reproductive rights in anticipation of the upcoming U.S. Supreme Court decision, and Governor Phil Murray has signed a bill that codifies abortion rights into state law. He also signed a second bill that expands insurance coverage for birth control. Meanwhile, of course, in states like Florida and South Dakota, lawmakers are rushing to impose new restrictions on abortion, anticipating that the court will acquiesce with much more restrictive rules. Knowing our Hoosier legislators as I do, I anticipate some pretty dreadful legislation being introduced here. It will require organization and activism in Indiana to derail what our ridiculous pro-gun, anti-vaccine legislators who call themselves pro-life will try to do. Indiana will need an enormous uprising of women, of men who support women, and especially of liberal churches if we're going to escape replicating the Handmaid's Tale here in Hoosier Land. A majority of Americans support reproductive rights, but protecting them will absolutely depend on whether that majority is activated. Thank you.